The recording that you're about to listen to is a talk from the City Bible Forum. We would appreciate you respecting our copyright by not making copies of this talk or altering the content in any way. We hope that you find the material beneficial. If you would like more information on the City Bible Forum, you can visit us on the web at citybibleforum.org.
Well, I'm not sure if you saw the photo of a human traffic jam on Mount Everest that went viral in about April this year. The question I want to ask is, why has summoning Mount Everest become so popular? I mean, I actually think it's very understandable to be literally on top of the world, to have that selfie with only the blue beyond behind you, the exhilaration, the sense of achievement. I'm pretty attached to the idea of doing extreme things and reaching the top of the world, to run the marathon or the ultra marathon, to ride the Tour de France, to be at the top of your chosen career. You want to leave your mark, don't you, to have a legacy, to be noteworthy. Why do so many of us get into heavy-duty sports or pursuits, particularly when we hit middle age? We don't want to fizzle out. We want to go out in a blaze of glory. I keep wanting to do extreme things myself, like going for 2 hours without coffee or not washing my keep cup ever. 21 years ago, just before the birth of my first daughter, I thought I'd run the Sea to Surf. Now, I know this is a bit lame for those marathon runners out there sitting at the back, but I really wanted to do this before my life changed forever. Now, I am honest in saying that I didn't train at all, apart from running for the train, but on the run, I hurt my knee, and I've never been able to run quite the same since. And then I went surfing in the last winter holidays. I told some of you this. I only started surfing when I was in high school, so I was never going to be any good. But the surf was absolutely massive. I went off the rocks, right, and my heart, was just pumping. And then this massive, absolutely massive set came through, and I got completely crunched. I got stuck in the kind of impact zone. Wave after wave after wave was on top of me. And I sort of just got washed in on the beach like some beached whale. And then actually the most humiliating thing is that the most glorious thing I ever did was in my early 20s. I did a bungee jump in New Zealand over the Shotover River, that kind of amazing swan dive into the blue aquamarine, right? The only problem is I went to my doctor last year and he said, look, your retina is bleeding, okay? And I didn't have the heart to tell him that, well, my eyes were kind of popping out when I did that bungee jump 20-something years ago. So, look, I fully get the desire we have for glory, but where can we find it? Which road shall we take? And is the cost worth it? Because actually, it can be pretty expensive. Take one of the mountaineers on Mount Everest. This guy's called Elias Akali. He's a Canadian adventurer. By the way, it cost $100,000 to get to the top of Everest. Did you know that? Well, this guy's done it 3 times. And actually, he's quoted in the newspaper as saying that the slow shuffle to the summit on the 26th of May earlier this year was unlike anything that he had ever seen before. Now, this is what he said. It was the sheer number of bodies he had to pass. On the way to Camp 4, there were 2 deceased climbers attached to the side of the trail waiting for evacuation. You can see in the photo there the circled body. Within 20 minutes, we passed another lifeless body, he said, that was being brought down. And then 3 hours into it, the 5th body was brought down just beneath the Hillary Step, the 6th. He said, you've got to ask yourself, what is going wrong here? Every single person that was attached to that summit had to step over that human being. It's devastating, he wrote. Well, there's got to be a better way, hasn't there? There's got to be a way to glory that, doesn't have to step over dead bodies to get it. Well, we do have such a guide. And the surprising guide is Mary. Let me tell you her story. We first meet her in the chapter before the one that George read this morning. And she, in that chapter, is the grieving sister of the dead man Lazarus. She's totally grief-stricken at the untimely death of her brother, completely devastated. And of course, everything massively changes for her when Jesus powerfully steps up to the tomb and calls that man, that dead man, out of the tomb. And out he comes with, the grave clothes still on him. Mary, along with her friends and relations, would have been absolutely awestruck of Jesus and his power in the face of death. Well, we next meet Mary at this dinner party referred to here. just a little while after this event, and it's given in honour of Jesus. And we pick up the story, verse 1. Can you see it there in your outlines? Sentence 1, verse 1. 6 days before the Passover, Jesus came to Bethany, where Lazarus lived, whom Jesus had raised from the dead. Here a dinner was given in Jesus' honour. Martha served, while Lazarus was among those reclining at the table with him. Well, the scene is set. It's most likely a Saturday night. The house would have been filled with guests. The guest of honour is Jesus, but if anyone doubted his greatness, they'd only just have to look to the side and there would be the dead man, Lazarus, who is now alive. But actually, it's what happens next that really grips the writer of this story. So if you have a look just down at verse 3, then Mary took about a pint of pure nard, an expensive perfume. She poured it on Jesus' feet and wiped his feet with her hair. And the house was filled with the fragrance of the perfume. Well, do you catch what's going on here? I mean, there's this dinner party and you're all sitting around in your togas, kind of reclining at couches. And then this beautiful scent just fills the air. This beautiful perfume wafts around. And then you notice there's this lady, Mary, kneeling at the feet of Jesus, and she's pouring this perfume and she begins to wipe his feet with her hair, which is even more astounding. Well, I want you to notice two things. Now, so great is Jesus to Mary that she places her whole life at his feet. And secondly, in so doing, she discovers the only true road to glory. So let's firstly consider the greatness of Jesus in Mary's eyes. I mean, I think if you're Ira there, the first thing that we would have noticed is the extravagant cost that has been paid, the outlandish cost, really, both financially and socially. I mean, we read that she poured out pure nard. Now, nard was an oil extracted from a plant grown in India, the nard plant. And it's pure. There's no dross in it. It's just pure, the genuine article. A pint of pure nard, about half a litre. That's a lot of perfume. And it wasn't any ordinary plonk. It was the best of the best, and it cost a pretty penny. They actually reckon that it would have cost a year's wages, 300 denarii, right? That's about $80,000 or so. I mean, who goes out and blows 80,000 bucks in a night? I mean, maybe some of our friends in finance, and then they blame it on the less than optimal market conditions or whatever due to challenging market scenario, whatever. But it's not just the financial cost that she was willing to pay. It was the social cost that she cheerfully paid. You know, we're told that, you know, she pours it out and she wipes Jesus' feet with her hair. Now, there's a Jewish sort of proverb, you know, that the rafters of a house would not see the hair of a godly Jewish woman. That is, it was a sign of loose morals to undo the hair. Mary undoes her hair in this public way and washes and dries Jesus' feet with it. See, Mary did not stop for a moment to calculate the public reaction. She just got on with it. I mean, washing someone's feet was considered the lowest of the low jobs for the lowest slaves. And in the very next chapter, actually, Peter refuses to have Jesus wash his feet. But Mary just pours out her devotion. What is going on here, really? I mean, perhaps she only really dimly understood what Jesus would go on to do, but so impressed is Mary with Jesus that she pours out her life at his feet. You know, so she so clearly gets how great Jesus is that she falls at his feet really in worship, and in so doing discovers the only sure road to glory, our second point. You know, Mary's story shows us this road to glory. To give up seeking honour for yourself and to live for the honour of Jesus with your whole life. That's it. Jesus says it even more starkly. You might know just towards the end of this chapter, Jesus says the one who loves his life will lose it, while the man who hates his life for this world, in this world will keep it for eternal life. Paradoxically, if you give up serving yourself, according to Jesus, You're going to be honoured by the Father. Jesus says later on in this chapter, my Father will honour the one who serves me. I mean, to get glory and honour, you've got to forget yourself and serve Jesus. I mean, don't you think it's extraordinary that, you know, 2,000 years after this event, we're still talking about it. We're talking about this lowly woman who did this act of devotion, but that wasn't in her mind at the time. She wasn't trying to get her 15 seconds of fame. It would have been the last thought on her mind. She gave up trying to honour herself in adoration of her Lord, and paradoxically, she is honoured. To forget self and serve another is the only way to true glory. We see this illustrated with a negative example next. Did you notice it? Because it actually wasn't so with Judas, whose actions prove him to be the diametrical opposite of Mary. We pick up the story, verse 4. Can you see it there? Verse 4. But one of the disciples, Judas Iscariot, who was later to betray him, objected, you know, why wasn't this perfume sold and the money given to the poor? It was worth a year's wages. He did not say this because he cared about the poor, but because he was a thief. As keeper of the money bag, he is to help himself to what was put in it. So not everyone reacted to Jesus as Mary did. You know, as the perfume spread through that house, it got up the nose of one man in particular, Judas. Now, we're told that as keeper of the money box, actually literally lifter of the money box, he would lift money for himself. He would help himself to what is there. You know, his protest is at this extravagant waste of money and this perfume being spilled all over the floor. And it's presented as concern for the poor. Why, Judas cried, you know, wasn't this perfume sold and the money given to the poor? It sounds altruistic, sounds like virtue signalling, doesn't it? But it masked a personal greed and a deep dissatisfaction with Jesus. Judas seemed to know nothing of, you know, Mary's unqualified and extravagant devotion to her Lord. You know, Judas found at this point his agenda clashing with the cross-bound Jesus. And actually, in Mark's account of this story, we're told that straight after this, Judas goes to the chief priests and accepts 30 pieces of silver to betray Jesus. So we're just going to pause and think, you know, what is Jesus' take on this incredible evening? I mean, is Mary a bit over the top? Is Judas concerned for the poor to be applauded? Well, we're not left in the dark because Jesus gives his assessment incredibly clearly. Can you see it there? Verse 7. Verse 7, Jesus replied, "Leave her alone." Sorry, I'll just move one more. "Leave her alone. She did this in preparation for my burial." So Jesus is so focused on his forthcoming death that he actually sees Mary's act as anointing his body, his dead body, for burial. You know, Mary's act had greater significance than she realized. That happens a little bit in John's Gospel, we know that. You know, Jesus speaks of himself as already being dead. He doesn't say this in preparation for my death. No, he says in preparation for my burial. After death comes burial. Yeah, the tradition, as we know, was to take spices and anoint the body with them. And this was in accordance with the regular funeral practices of the Jews. So have a look in the bottom of the page here. This chapter 19, we read about what Joseph and Nicodemus did. John 19, later, Joseph of Arimathea asked Pilate for the body of Jesus. Now, Joseph was a disciple of Jesus, but secretly because he feared the Jewish leaders. With Pilate's permission, he came and took the body away. He was accompanied by Nicodemus, the man who earlier had visited Jesus at night. Nicodemus brought a mixture of myrrh and aloes, about 75 pounds, taking Jesus' body. The two of them wrapped it with the spices in strips of linen. This was in accordance with Jewish burial customs. See, you know, like Mary, these two took the incredibly risky position of identifying with Jesus. You know, it could have cost them their jobs with the Sanhedrin. We're told in chapter 3 that Nicodemus was a member of this Jewish ruling council. I mean, Pilate was such an irascible leader, he was so unpredictable, that he could very well have killed them. right? He was an incredibly unstable character. But whatever the cost, they were prepared to identify with Jesus, like Mary. So they too discovered the true way to glory. So what does this all mean for us? Sydney, 2019. I mean, you know, I imagine there are actually two groups among us this morning. There are those who are followers of Jesus and those who are still sort of checking it out. For those who are not yet following Jesus, I want to, you know, thank you so much for being here this morning. The first thing to say is that this is not all there is to say about this topic. I'm going to speak next week on the part two. But the second thing I want to raise with you, if I may, is to ask you to ponder the cost you have paid so far in your quest for glory, whatever your personal Everest happens to be. Who have you had to step over, metaphorically speaking, to get where you are? Remember the quote from our Canadian adventurer? Every single person attached to that summit that day had to step over that human being. It's devastating. Who have we had to step over and leave behind? I have this friend in finance, and he said I could share this story. He said to me, you know, about 18 months ago, he had this incredibly intense period at work. He literally got the last bus home in the evening and the first bus back to work in the morning. He was working 18 hours a day or so. And one night he came home, and on the kitchen bench was a letter. It was from his daughter, about 11 years old. And the daughter said, "Dear Daddy, when are we going to see you again?" The thing was, that was the second night the daughter had left the note out, because the night before he hadn't seen it at all. And that caused that man to think about what cost is he paying. So I wanted to ask you as well, you know, will your Everest last, whatever it is? You know, I've read statistics on the deaths on Mount Everest, and actually a far higher proportion happen after people summit. It's after the summit. That's when the real danger zone is. You know, coming down from the pinnacle of your achievement, whatever it be, sporting, financial, relational. So you've climbed your Mount Everest. Well, what then? What's next? Is your glory going to last? Well, for those of you who do follow Jesus, may I can ask you to consider what would it look like for you to be wholehearted in your devotion like Mary? What's it going to look like for us to boots and all commit to following Jesus, regardless of financial and social cost? I mean, do you really think Jesus is who he says he is? And if so, what are you prepared to do as a result of your devotion to him? Now, you know that sometimes there's shame associated with following Jesus, and I actually think increasingly so. You know, Jesus warned us, if anyone's ashamed of me and my words, I will be ashamed of him when I come in glory. You know, consider Mary. She knew way less than many of us know about the person of Jesus, yet she willingly and gladly identified with him regardless of cost. Well, was it worth it? Was it worth it for Mary to identify with Jesus in this way? Well, I'd argue yes. 2,000 years later, here we are talking about her. But she didn't set out to seek her own glory. She gave up her quest for glory and paradoxically found the glory she wasn't looking for. It was the clarity with which she saw Jesus that led her to abandon all. Now, the text gives us a little clue about the immediate future of Jesus. Verse 9, can you see it there? Verse 9. Meanwhile, a large crowd of Jews found out that Lazarus was there and came, not because of him, but also to see Lazarus, whom he'd raised from the dead. So the chief priests made plans to kill Lazarus as well. For on account of him, many of the Jews were going over to Jesus and believing in him. Jesus would willingly go to his death, suffering the shame and ignominy of the death on a cross, that so that we don't have to suffer God's judgment alone. I actually stumbled on this incredible verse the other day in the letter to the Hebrews. It says, "And so Jesus suffered outside the city gate to make the people holy through his own blood. Let us then go to him outside the camp, bearing the disgrace he bore." He suffered shame so we don't have to. And yeah, doesn't that strengthen your resolve to stand up for Jesus regardless of the cost? Thanks so much for these questions. First one, Jesus performed miracles and yet wept on seeing Lazarus dead. As he was wholly divine and wholly human, how and why did he choose between the two? I take that between the two of letting Lazarus die. I think that's the option. Good point. So this helps us to go back into the context of this story, which is John chapter 11 and the death of Lazarus. Now, we're told in the beginning of chapter 11 that he actually delayed going 4 days. When Jesus heard that Lazarus said, he delayed 4 days. Right? Why was that? Well, we're told that it's because Jesus wanted to reveal his glory. More of that next week. But I think this question is helpful because it takes us to the horror of death. So when Jesus stood at the tomb, we're told, or just before that, we're told twice that the word actually is angry. Jesus was angry. He wept greatly and he was grieving, but the word has a concept of anger. Why is that? Now, he knows that actually in a couple of minutes he's going to raise Lazarus out of the tomb, so why was he so upset? Well, I take it that Jesus is absolutely devastated and angry at the devastation that death causes. Death is not normal. It's not the normal way. It's an ugly intrusion into human life. We are immortal beings. We're meant to live forever. So last night, two nights ago, a family friend of ours, the auntie died. This auntie had raised this man who brought this man to Australia. Just the grief that occurs when we lose a loved one. Jesus is angry at death. Yet the raising of Lazarus from the dead points to his own resurrection, whereby he defeated death. And so Jesus says in John 11, he who believes in me will live even though he dies. Do you think Nicodemus became a Christian? It's a very good question. Earlier in the Gospel, we see that Nicodemus comes to Jesus at night. Why does he come at night? Well, I think because he's scared. We're actually told earlier in John's Gospel that the Jews had already decided that anyone that followed Jesus would be put out of the synagogue, like excommunication. I mean, that would be an horrendous thing. Nicodemus kind of creeps around to see Jesus at night because he can't quite come to him openly in the day. But I take it by his actions in chapter 19 of going to Pilate and asking for Jesus' body and dealing with his body with such a respectful way at great personal cost, I think he attached himself to Jesus. He counted the cost and became a follower, which is a great story, isn't it? Was Judas Iscariot a Jewish zealot and felt betrayed by Jesus dying before any Jewish uprising against the Roman Empire could succeed? It's another very good question that takes us back into the context of the day. We know there were zealots, a group called the Zealots, who believed in armed uprising against the Roman oppressors and would be involved in stabbings and murders and so on. And we know that actually some of the crowds earlier in the Gospels wanted to actually make Jesus king by force. We're told that earlier in John's Gospel. They perceived in Jesus the solution to the political situation they're in. And so, well, it may well have been that at this point, Judas realized that Jesus wasn't the Messiah he was hoping for. Next question. Why was Mary already preparing for Jesus' burial? John 12, verse 7. She may have only seen dimly that Jesus was headed to the cross. She probably didn't know all the details. The disciples, even though Jesus warned them 3 times that he would die, he'd be killed, mocked, you know, and rise from the dead, they didn't understand what he was talking about. And I think Mary wouldn't have understood that. But she saw somehow in Jesus the answer, and so was prepared in this lavish way to express her connection. I think she's, a colloquial way of putting it is that she was pinning all her hopes on him. She was with him 100%. She was going boots and all. She was throwing her lot in with Jesus come what may. And that's why she's a great model for us too. We may not know everything about Jesus, but he's worthy of us putting our trust in him. Part two, does it not make sense for Mary to use her hair so that she may have the joy of the fragrance through her hair? I mean, we can understand that. I can't understand it, obviously. But I think we need to understand the context, and we understand from the ancient world that to loosen the hair for a woman in public was a sign of loose morals. So there was a stigma attached to that, but she, regardless of stigma, was prepared to identify with Jesus, and that's the link with us in terms of, are we prepared to suffer shame for being attached to Jesus? The wise men brought gold, frankincense and myrrh when Jesus was born. Nicodemus and Joseph of Arimathea brought myrrh and aloes after his death. Interesting comparison. Why the difference? It's a fascinating question, and I'll have to think about that more. I haven't thought about that one before, but I guess to say that both are expensive. And we're told that Nicodemus and Joseph bought 75 pounds. I think it's 3.5 kilos, I mean, or more. It's a lot of stuff. So, sorry, what's that, Lisa?
85.
Oh, yeah, 35 kilos. There we are. Thank you for the calculation. So it's a huge amount and very expensive.
The recording that you have just listened to is from the City Bible Forum. For more information about City Bible Forum events in your city, or to order other talks, please visit citybibleforum.org.